Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. I bet you get 30, 30, I bet you get 30, I bet you get 20, 20, 20, I bet you get 20, 20, I bet you get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month, sold.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Live from the BBC, The Naked Scientists.
You are listening to The Naked Scientists, and it's me. I'm in charge. Ha ha ha. We've put Chris in a basement somewhere. That's a lie. You'll be hearing from Chris later. It's me, Dr. Kat, and we're here with Dr. Sarah.
Hello.
And with the wonderful Mandy Morton, who's keeping all the filters open and the buttons pressed.
Doing our best.
Doing our absolute best. Chris is away in America at the AAAS Science Conference, and we'll be hearing from him later about what he's found out this week. And we're going to be back in the studio here talking about nature's medicine chest. How can plants cure us all of all our nasty aches and pains? So for thousands and thousands of years, we've been using Chinese medicine over in China, and the West has sort of shunned this in favour of conventional medicine. But we're going to be talking to Monique Simmons.
Hello.
Who's from Kew Gardens, and she's going to be talking about researching plants to make drugs. So I'll be really interested to hear about that later. She's also running a programme to find out about people's recollections of herbal remedies. So maybe you could phone in with yours later. And also we're joined by Taiping Fan. So hi, Taiping.
Hi, good evening.
And he's from Cambridge University and is an expert on traditional Chinese medicine. And later we'll be hearing how he's been researching the chemicals in Chinese medicine that actually have their effect. So if you've got any questions about plants, making drugs from plants, do you have any herbal remedies of your own? Do you remember Granny poking you with some leaf and telling you to eat this, it'll make you better? Give us a call, 08459 25 2000. Get emailing us in as well at chris@thenakedscientist.com. So we want to hear from you now, 08459 25 2000. Sarah.
Thanks, Kat. Also on the show, we're going to be looking at some current news stories. We're going to be telling you about a new drug called modafinil to help keep you awake. And from Kat, we're going to be hearing how music enhances the effects of ecstasy. We'll also be going off to listen to the Mildenhall College of Technology battening down the hatches as Derek takes along some exploding flour for kitchen science. And as usual, you can have a go at our quiz, science fact or science fiction. We'll ask you a question and you have to say whether the answer is true or false. It's that simple. And tonight we've got some great prizes. We've got two tickets to the Royal Botanic Gardens at Kew, or we've got £20 worth of Wiggly Wigglers vouchers to get some worms for your compost bin. So lots of great plant related prizes, and to win them, get calling. Ring us on 08459 25 2000.
The Naked Scientist Podcast, brought to you by thenakedscientist.com.
Thanks, Mandy. Now, there's a new drug that can help keep you awake, which I wasn't sure about this. It's called modafinil.
I could do with that now. I'm absolutely shattered. I've had a big weekend moving house.
Oh, you poor thing.
Tell us more.
That's such a stressful thing. Now, there's a company in America called Kefalon, which have developed this drug to help people with narcolepsy and sleep apnea who have awful problems. People with narcolepsy keep falling asleep and often fall asleep at the wheel. And people with sleep apnea snore terribly and keep waking up through the night because their airway blocks, and they really don't get a very refreshing night's sleep at all.
Well, they haven't got many friends either, I imagine.
Yeah, it's not good for wives when people snore. Now, what you do with this drug, you take it before bed, and then about 4 or 5 hours later, you wake up and feel really ready to get up and go because it's a stimulant, and it can actually keep you awake for up to 48 hours.
My goodness, it's the sort of thing people taking exams, this sort of stuff. It used to be Pro Plus, didn't it? So this is the new Pro Plus.
Although I tried caffeine tablets once when I was a student to write an essay, and I have to say I fell asleep, so it didn't work very well.
Oh, they just make me feel sick.
I hope modafinil's more effective. Modafinil is what's called a eugeroid, and that's a Greek word, which means good arousal. So it reminds me a bit of sildenafil, which is Viagra.
Combine the two, you could have something really big on your hands.
Okay, can you? I wasn't sure about this, though, because I thought, gosh, it must be exhausting to sort of stay awake for 48 hours. But apparently you really do feel very alert, very awake, and you can get on with whatever you've got to do. So it's good potentially for people in the military, pilots,
doctors.
They could go back to the 24-hour on-call days, couldn't they? Yuck.
Is it good for us, though? Because, I mean, the natural way of things is the fact that we work, we eat, we sleep. And we do that right from the moment that we're conceived. So, I mean, is it good for us?
Well, I'm not sure. I mean, we spend a third of our lives asleep. And sleep is
which is
healing.
A shame, isn't it, really?
We believe sleep helps to repair neurons in the brain. It helps to get our brain ready for the next day's activity. And so I just wonder if, you know, there could be some long-term effects. Mm. They say that it doesn't have any particularly bad side effects other than headaches, but I guess time will tell and we'll have to see what happens.
So when you're awake, you've got a headache. Marvellous. Good stuff.
Well, I've got another story here about drugs and their effect on the brain, but this is ecstasy, the clubber's drug. And some scientists in Italy have done an experiment which shows what clubbers for years have actually known, that if you take ecstasy and then listen to loud music, it sort of enhances the effects of ecstasy. Now, why is this important? So they did an experiment where they took rats and they gave some of them ecstasy. So these little E'd up rats going, yeah, having it. And all these other rats that were just given salt solutions, so they're sitting there going, right, okay. Mm. And they played them music, or they didn't play them music, or sort of sounds, like electronic sounds, the sort of thing that you get in nightclubs. And then they monitored their brains. And they found out that if they gave the rats ecstasy, then for 5 days afterwards, their brains were still affected by the ecstasy, if they were listening to music as well. But if they gave the rats ecstasy and didn't play the music, then the effects only lasted for a day. So, you know, although ecstasy is an illegal drug, don't take it, kids. If you do, stay at home.
It's interesting.
So you go
clubbing Friday and Saturday night, and your brain, you're still clubbing
still
till Wednesday.
Yeah, your brain is still broken until the following week. So, yes, don't do that.
Well, as we mentioned earlier, even though Chris isn't about this week, he's still out there digging around for good science stories, and he's on the line now. Chris, are you hearing us loud and clear?
Loud and clear here in St. Louis, at the gateway to the Midwest, I'm told.
Tell us exactly what you're up to.
Well, this is the AAAS. It's the American Association for the Advancement of Science, or at least it would be if anyone was here. It was quite ironic that yesterday we were looking for life elsewhere in the universe with Maggie Turnbull from Carnegie Institution in Washington, and she's narrowed down 5 stars that she thinks might be good contenders as places to look for life. But we haven't yet discovered any life here in St. Louis.
Perhaps they've all gone to the moon.
I think they've gone somewhere, but they haven't come here. The thing is that this is in the middle of America, and the problem that sets is that there's a big geographical divide between where the people are and where the conference is. And so this conference, which is supposed to be reaching out to the general public and telling people about what the scientists in America are up to, and in fact scientists from all over the world who are here speaking, well, that's a bit of a difficulty if no one can come. So it's another challenge is that it's minus 16 outside today.
So
yes, it's pretty bracing. The Mississippi, which flows through here, is freezing up, and there's no one here. But other than that, we're having a great time because the science is fantastic and second to none.
I tell you what, Chris, you're feeling a bit miserable out there.
It's a bit chilly.
We've had an email here, and it says that it's from Lee Thompson, and he says, "Dr. Chris, I've listened to the question and answer podcast. Is there anything you don't know for an egghead you totally rock?"
Fantastic.
Does that make you feel better?
Well, one of the things you were talking about just now was modafinil, of course, the stay-awake drug. And one of the reasons that that's also popular is because it has a memory-boosting effect. So if anyone out there wants to rival my memory for things, and I do actually have a photographic memory, then perhaps a dose of modafinil will help you to do that.
I've got a photographic memory, but the batteries have run out.
Yeah, you need to flash more.
That's her excuse, and she's sticking to it.
So what else have you heard out there, Chris?
Well, one of the things which we were talking about, apart from looking for life in St. Louis and looking for life on Mars, was GM crops. And I got talking to a guy called Yoshi Shapiro yesterday from Monsanto, the big GM crop giant. And they've actually made a form of potato plant which contains a bacterial toxin. It's called BT toxin. And he had a wonderful demonstration where he had 2 potato plants. One was a genetically modified potato plant, and the other one was a normal plant. And they'd infested them with something called a Colorado beetle. And these beetles are voracious, hungry eaters, and they would demolish potato crops in no time. And he actually talked me through exactly how this demonstration works.
We have 2 potato plants here. One is a traditional or conventional potato plant. The other is genetically enhanced potato. They're both infested with small Colorado potato beetle larvae, and the larvae are feeding on the 2 types of potato plants. On the traditional potato plants, the larvae survive, and we can start to see it, significant amounts of damage happening where the insects are feeding. They're eating holes through the leaves. On the genetically enhanced potato plant, which is enhanced with a Bacillus thuringiensis protein.
In other words, a toxin that's going to kill the beetle.
That's right. It's a toxin that's very specific for the order Coleoptera, which are beetles, to which the Colorado potato beetles belong. And so that particular plant that produces the protein in the cells will kill the insects that feed on it. The good thing about this particular protein is that it has a very narrow range of activity. And so other insects and all other organisms, aside from beetles, would not be affected.
Not toxic to humans?
Not at all toxic to humans, that's right. It's called BT for Bacillus thuringiensis. That is the bacterium that in nature produces this class of toxins. The BT toxins have been used for probably 60 years or more as foliar applied insecticides and have a history of safe usage.
And how did you actually get the plants to make the toxin? How do you do that?
Well, it's through molecular biology techniques. We can insert genes and the genetic elements that control the expression of genes into the DNA of the plant cells, and then the plant itself will begin to produce the protein that the gene encodes.
Can you just talk us through the nuts and bolts of how you actually make a GM crop?
There are a couple of ways that are commonly used for inserting these particular constructs into plant cells. One is called agrobacterium transformation, and that involves the use of a bacterium that will insert its own DNA naturally into plant cells of the plants that it infects. Those bacteria have been disarmed so that they're not inserting their own DNA, but rather they're inserting the DNA of interest. So that's the construct with which we want to modify the plant cell. So that's one way. The other way is to do it through what's called the biolistic method, which is a means of bombarding DNA with small pellets that are coated with the genes of interest, and thereby inserting the DNA sequence of the construct into the DNA of the plant.
What about spread of the gene to other plants in nature? Is that a risk?
Well, with something like potato, it's not a risk because potato is typically not grown to flower. Potato is propagated asexually or by, you know, pieces of potato. And so the flow of pollen is not a risk. With other crops, there may be some concerns, and so that is something that needs to be studied and remediated in one way or another.
But in the context of this potato pest, how much could this save someone in the third world growing potatoes if they were succumbing to pests like this?
Well, these Colorado potato beetle are particularly voracious feeders. And as you can see, the damage that's been done to this plant has happened in a relatively short span of time just this afternoon. If we were to come back here tomorrow, these insects will have continued to feed. And before the conference is over, that plant will no longer have any leaves, it won't have any chance of making a potato crop. In many cases, let's say in the case of subsistence farmers who would not maybe have the means or the wherewithal to apply pesticides, it may make the difference between having a potato crop and not having a potato crop at all.
It was Monsanto's Yoshi Shapiro cooking up a much less palatable potato using genetically modified crop technology.
Well, Chris, before you go, we've got a caller on the line for you. This is David from Royston. David, you're through to Dr. Chris.
Hello, Chris.
Hello.
GM crops, soybeans, grains of rice, wheat, how do they actually come about? What do they do to them?
Well, as Yossi was just sort of outlining there, one of the ways in which you do this is to resort to biotechnology. In other words, you can use techniques which are standard laboratory techniques to do this. Now, one of the things that you can do is to use a bacterium, and it's called Agrobacterium tumor faciens. It's a soil-living bacterium, but it's naturally evolved a way to genetically modify plants. Now, the way it does that is it has an element called a transposon, and these transposons are little pieces of DNA which can insert themselves into the genetic material of a plant. So what you do is to insert into that transposon the genes that you want to transfer into a plant. You then disarm the bacterium so that it's unable to do what it normally does, and you use that technique to move the gene you want into the plant's DNA, moving in with it the genes that you want to transfer to the plant. The reason the bacterium normally does this is because it wants to encourage an area of growth on the root of the plant, or the stem of the plant, a gall in other words, which is an ideal home for that bacterium. And so you're using what nature's already provided and subverting it into producing another kind of plant for you with some additional techniques and characteristics.
How about that, David?
Yeah, does this make it a bigger crop as such, or just a stronger crop?
It depends what you move in, David. You can put genes for a whole range of different things into that. One of the things you can put in is a gene which gives you resistance to a pesticide, for example, so that you can spray your field with that particular pesticide, or a fungicide or something. The plant is not sensitive to it, but any other plants in the field are. So, for instance, cereal crops can be made to be resistant to a herbicide, something that kills grasses, but not that particular plant. Or you can make the plant naturally resistant to certain kinds of insect pests, so that when the insects eat the plant, rather like those potato plants, the insects die.
Yeah. And am I right in saying that majority of GM crops at the moment are into animal feeds more so than human feeds? Or is it, I think I've done a little bit of research in terms of golden rice from America.
There's a lot of things on the supermarket shelves here in America, and people here in America have been eating genetically modified plants for a very, very long time, and in fact they've been in the UK for a very, very long time. The amount of regulation required to prove that they're safe is very intensive.
Yeah.
Okay, David?
Yep, thank you.
Now, David, we'd like you to hang on because we'd love you to play Fact or Fiction.
Thank you.
Lovely. So we shall now move on to, the quiz that's got everybody going around the counties.
Exactly.
And 08459 25 2000, if you've got any questions to put to Dr. Chris, because Dr. Chris is listening throughout the programme today. So if you want to baffle him with a bit of your science, then give us a call, 08459 25 2000. Kat.
So here we have the quiz for you, David.
Okay.
All right. Earth, air, fire and salt were the four elements proposed by the ancient Greeks. Is that fact or fiction?
Fact.
Sorry, David, that's actually fiction. It's actually earth, air, fire and water, not salt.
Right.
I keep thinking that's earth, wind and fire. Maybe Mandy can tell us more about
that. I'm not singing.
A second question. Venus and Mercury are planets with no moons. Is that fact or fiction?
Fact.
Well done. Yeah, all the other planets have at least one moon.
All right, you've got one out of two, so you'll find out if you're the winner. Anyone else at home, if you think you can do better than David in Royston, get calling in 08459 25 2000. And if you have any questions for our guests, for Monique and Tai Ping, who are here to talk all about sort of nature's medicine chest and the treasures within it. Have you used herbal remedies? Did they work? Did they not work? Do you have plants in your garden that you use? Maybe your granny was really into herbal medicine. Get phoning in 08459 25 2000.
The Naked Scientists, supported by the Wellcome Trust.
Well, now we're off for some kitchen science, and this week Derek is at the Mildenhall College of Technology in Suffolk. He's joined by Cambridge University physicist Helen Chersky and student helper J.I., and they're going to be finding out about the explosive power of flour. Hi, Derek.
Hi there, and welcome to Mildenhall College of Technology in Suffolk, and we've come to do some fantastic experiments today. With me is actually a new recruit to the Naked Scientist, who's going to be setting up a couple of experiments for us on this kitchen science feature. Could you just introduce yourself and tell us where you work?
Hi, my name's Helen Chersky, and I'm a PhD student at the Cavendish Laboratory in Cambridge.
Okay then, and could you just quickly tell us, Sam, what kind of things we're going to be doing today?
We're going to be blowing things up, but not any fancy explosives. We're just going to be blowing up plain, ordinary flour like you'd find in your kitchen. But don't try this at home, because I don't want to get into trouble with your parents.
OK, yes, so that's a very good point from Helen there. Please do not try this at home, but do please listen to what's going to happen, because we are going to be making some stuff happen and also explaining it. Helen's going to be explaining what's going on. Also with us is a student from Mildenhall College of Technology, who's come very kindly to actually do this experiment really for us. Could you please introduce yourself and tell us what year you're in as well?
I'm Jai Fu, and I'm in year 11.
Excellent. Nice to have you with us. And so are you into science? What science are you doing?
Chemistry is my main one, actually, yeah.
OK, well, which branch of science do you think this mainly focuses on?
Well, I'm a physicist, so I think it's mostly physics, but it's got a fair bit of chemistry in there as well.
OK, good stuff. So, Helen, then, what have we got set up in front of us?
So what I have here is a very large transparent box. It's about a foot long on each side. It's a cube, and it's see-through, so we can see through the walls. And inside it, we've got two candles that are burning, and also we've got a funnel poking up through the bottom of the box, and the funnel is full of flour. And Jai there is going to blow down the tube, and so flour will get puffed up into the box, and we're going to have a look at what happens.
OK, so what we've actually got then is this funnel is kind of pointing down out of the box, and so there's a load of flour kind of put into it, and there's a tube stretching all the way up to Jai, who's holding it in his hand. And so when Jai blows down this tube, the flour which is resting in the funnel is going to get puffed up, as Helen said, into the air, which is kind of in that big transparent box. And we've got two candles burning there as well. So all that remains to be done is for Jai to actually blow the air. Are you ready, Jai?
Yep.
Good stuff, and we have been doing some practicing as well, so we're ready to get this. Right, so here we go. Let's blow that flour into the box.
Wicked! Excellent, well done.
OK, so well done, Jai. I mean, describe to me, what happened in there?
Well, put simply, it exploded. The reason being, I think, is that, of course, flour contains a lot of chemical potential energy, and, of course, that's being burnt into heat energy when, by the flame, of course.
Thank you. Yeah, that's great. So basically, yeah, we had two candles in there, and the flour was just kind of being puffed up, suspending itself in the air, and then suddenly a whole whoosh, which is what you heard, of flame just kind of swept across and actually pushed some air out of the box, which is kind of what we heard. So Helen's here, of course, to explain it. So Helen, what was happening there?
Well, what was happening is that the flour is acting as a fuel. Now, flour won't burn if you have a pile of it and just put a match on top of it. It goes a bit black and smells horrid, but it won't burn. Because what you need in order to burn is both a fuel, which is the flour, and oxygen. And there's oxygen in the air. So if you can mix together the fuel and the oxygen so they're right next to each other, then you've got a good chance of getting some burning going. So that's what we did. Puffing the flour up into the air meant it mixed the flour with the air. And then that drifted down. And when it touched the flame, it got hot enough and it started to burn. And because it's inside a box, if a little bit of it burns, it generates some gas. The pressure builds up. So when the next bit burns, it burns even faster. And then the pressure builds up more and it burns up faster. So if you do it inside a box, you can actually get a proper explosion.
So we really saw an explosion, and also we kind of had some hissing sounds as the air kind of rushed out, and actually all of us, didn't we? We kind of felt some hot air, do you think?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I definitely did.
Yeah, exactly. There was kind of like a rush of hot air as it all came out. So, I mean, this was because, what, it's going from a fuel into a gas?
That's right. Well, the fuel is a solid, but when things burn, when most things burn, they generate gases, and the gas takes up much more space than the solid. So if you generate a gas, it wants to spread out and expand and push against something else. So there are some little gaps in the box, and so when the pressure of the gas inside built up, all that air wanted to go somewhere else because there's too much to be inside the box. So it whooshed out, and everyone took a step backwards. It was very funny.
Absolutely, yeah. No, I was certainly included in that. So excellent. Well, thank you for your efforts, Jai. Of course, there's one more question, which is, how does this kind of relate to some more practical things like engines and so on? So what about that?
Well, for example, whenever anything burns, you need a fuel-air mixture, and you get that as well in the internal combustion engine. You squirt fuel into the cylinders in your car, and it mixes with the air there, and you get exactly the same kind of explosion, and that's what drives the piston, which drives your car.
Okay, and so when you don't have that kind of suspension, it just doesn't really work so well.
What you need is a mixture. You always need the oxygen and the fuel to be right next to each other, because you can't have a reaction with two things that are too far apart. So it's all about mixing the right things together.
Well, thank you very much, Helen. So we have been blowing up flour here. Once again, we would advise you not to do this at home, but I hope you've heard in very great detail exactly how it looked and what it was like here. So thank you very much for that, Helen and Jai. And that's all from Mildenhall College of Technology. So please do join us next time for some more kitchen science somewhere in the east of England. Until then, goodbye.
Thanks for that, Derek, and well done to Jai for avoiding blowing up the school. I wonder if they're all dusty and covered in flour now.
Don't do it at home, kids. Please don't blow stuff up at home.
Now, next week on Kitchen Science, Derek and Dave are going to be in Hertfordshire looking at the science behind what makes gravy thick. We always used to fight for the lumps when I was at school.
Fantastic.
Weirdo.
Well, we're taking your calls 08459 25 2000. Remember, our guests in the studio, Monique Simmons and Taiping Fan. We are talking about plants that help to fight diseases and traditional Chinese medicines. If you've got any idea of any sort of questions to do with that, and we are particularly interested in your family's remedies, particularly sort of pre-1945. If Granny had a remedy, remedy that always used to work, and it was something to do with plants, you know, these poultices and all these disgusting things that they used to put together to solve the toothache and all that sort of thing. We would like to hear from you. 08459 25 2000. Give us a call now here on The Naked Scientist. Kat?
Yep, and also now, just before we go to Monique and Taiping, we have this week's podcast pick. Petro's been scanning the airwaves to find a new podcast for us. We have one this week from Tim Kammer, who's at skepticmoment.com, and he's going to tell us all about the healing power of crystals.
Crystals, formed by the solidification of chemicals regularly repeating internal arrangements of atoms and molecules, bounded by external plane faces. And this is why crystals have stimulated our imaginations? Many New Agers and modern occultists say crystals channel good energy and ward off bad energy. They say crystals carry vibrations that resonate with healing frequencies and can be used to heal us physically and emotionally. Some believe crystals can also help with self-expression, creativity, meditation, and the immune system. These beliefs are based on nothing more than testimonials, the placebo effect, and selective and wishful thinking. But I must say, crystals do look nice and definitely have some properties useful in electronics and optics.
That was Tim Kammer. And if you want to hear any more about his podcast, where he looks at science fact and science fiction, visit his website, which is www.skepticmoment.com. And also, if you have a podcast of your own, you can email it into us as an MP3. We want about a minute and a half. If you have science stories to tell, maybe you know a tame scientist who would tell us about what they're doing, email it into chris@nakedscientist.com, and you could be picked by Petro and put on the air. So we've just been hearing about crystal healing and debunking that. But what about the healing powers of plants? Monique, hello.
Hello, good evening.
So you're actually looking at plants that really do heal and trying to suss out why. Can you tell us a bit more about what you do?
I'm working at the Royal Botanic Gardens, Kew, and we've got a team of people who are at the moment concentrating actually on British plants, because we've actually neglected our own back garden. We've been working on everybody else's the last few years. And we're going back and looking at some of those traditional uses where we can't really explain how they work. So is there any substance behind it? So the group of scientists at Kew are involved in helping to isolate the different compounds in these plants and then studying to see if they can explain how they work. So we're using different techniques to fractionate the compounds. You start off basically with like a tea, an infusion from the plant. And one of the keys to our work is really concentrating on how the plants were traditionally used and when in the year that they were collected, because often we've made mistakes and somebody's come to us and said, well, this plant was used for X, Y, and Z, and we've just gone out possibly into the gardens at Kew, collected it and paid no attention to when it was traditionally used.
So, well, can you give us an example of that?
Well, for example, some of the work that we've done on figwarts, which is used in the early part of the year, it doesn't contain the same compounds later on. So it's really important to get it in the springtime. Similar type of thing for goosegrass, which is used for wound healing.
So goosegrass, the stuff with all the little burrs that stick on the dog.
Yes, the cleavers, that's right. Now, that has been traditionally used to treat leg ulcers. Now, over the last few years that we've been studying it, we've identified some compounds that have antibacterial activity, so that kind of protects the wound as it's healing. It also has a little bit of antioxidant and anti-inflammatory, but it also stimulates fibroblasts. Now, these are the cells that need to multiply to help heal a wound.
So it suggests there's lots of good stuff in there. Do you think if you just purify one chemical out to turn into a drug, you risk losing all the other good stuff that's in there?
Yes, I think from our work, when we've tested the kind of the crude infusion and then isolated, we often find that the activity is lost.
And how are you finding your ideas? Yeah, are you asking your granny? Where do you get your ideas?
Well, it comes from a range of different sources. Partly it is a kind of granny's remedies. It's remembered remedies, plants that were used before 1945, before the health service came in. It's a real source of information. So it's partly to find out our own traditional use and to conserve that use. So that's a source of information. And then we go back to some of the older herbals. So it's a combination of information. Now, we don't want to investigate things that have already been well studied. We're looking for new leads, basically.
So something like peppermint, which has been quite well studied. You wouldn't necessarily
not
be
really unless
in...
it was a new use. So far, you know, there's lots of plants that are coming up again and again, like dock and dandelion and elder. Now, okay, elder used frequently, but actually we don't fully know how it's used. Another example is crab apple. Now, crab apple was used to treat forms of cancer like stomach cancer and colon cancer. Why? We don't really know.
Do they have antibacterial properties? Because a lot of stomach cancer is caused by a bacteria that lives in the stomach under acidic conditions.
Yes, this could be what's happening. And having fundamental knowledge about some of the role of the compounds in the ecology of a plant, because plants produce these compounds not as medicines for us, but to actually protect themselves from being attacked by viruses, fungi, and also things like insects, we actually can make some advances. So if it's a natural antibacterial, then that's where we'll often start.
So sometimes when I used to live at home, I'd see my dog going out in the garden and eating stuff and then being copiously sick. Is it true that animals will seek out plants that can help make them better?
Yes, there's quite a lot of evidence that they do, especially if they've got infestations of fleas and things, that they will rub themselves in things like lavender to get rid of some of the insects. And then if you look at the behaviour of apes, where they will take some of the fruits to kind of purge themselves of, say, things like nematodes in intestine infections. So there's quite a lot of evidence that animals are selecting.
Is that something that you're looking at to learn from animals and what they do so that you can get clues to what to look at next?
We do take into account that, but there's so much that we could do here that we have to kind of put some blinkers on, otherwise we'd just be overpowered. We'd love to really kind of tinker with everything, but we can't, because otherwise we'd never deliver something. There's such a rich source of information out there. It just justifies so much further research.
Monique, once this information is gathered, are you going to try and reproduce this, or obviously you'll be passing the information on so that it can be reproduced chemically, so that we can you know, just go to the doctors and they will be prescribing pills that will have these properties in them?
Yes, I mean, the main emphasis of our project is to understand what is going on. At some time, I'm sure we will actually isolate some of the really active ingredients, and that's where the compounds from the plant will most likely act as models and then will be synthesised. There is a stage where we might be able to help identify the proportion of compounds that should be there, and that's when you could have something produced as a kind of medicinal drug. But I think it's one thing that you've really got to be careful on these is when a plant works and you take it, you've got to be so careful that you're not mixing it with some of the traditional medicines, because of an active plant then in combination with another form of drug, you get adverse responses. And when you get many of those, unfortunately, the authorities will often act to ban the plant. Mm. So it's got to be really careful.
It's St John's wort is a problem, isn't it? That's
St John's, St John's wort, yes. And you get things interfering with things like warfarin. A lot of people are taking to decrease the blood flow, etc. And when you get these interactions, and it's also affecting what's happening in your liver.
I was just going to say it's actually a problem with the pill as well, because people often take St John's wort if they're feeling a bit depressed, and then it interferes with their contraceptive pill.
And it doesn't work.
Unwanted pregnancies, which is not ideal.
Monique, can you just tell us really briefly about your Remembered Remedies project? How can our listeners get involved in that?
It would be great if they could look back in their records or talk to some of the elder members of the family and get in contact with us at Q. To provide that information of which plants were being used for themselves, but also maybe for their animals. Now, this is a collaborative project with herbalists and ethnobotanists that are helping to collect the remedies throughout Britain. And we really would appreciate it, because often you think, OK, everybody knows that, but they don't. And one of the keys is, did they use the plants in combination with other plants, or was it by themselves? And please provide information about where the plants we used, because the soil has an effect on the chemistry of the plant. So a plant picked from, say, Norfolk or Cambridge might have a very different composition of chemicals than some, say, from Scotland or from Cornwall.
So if you've got anything at home, you know, any herbs lurking, you can email it in to us at chris@thenakedscientist.com. We'll also have Monique's details on our website, which is www.nakedscientist.com. And you can also phone in the show on 08459 25 2000. Tell us about it. What did your granny used to get up to? Do you still use herbal remedies at home? We'd love to hear from you.
But 08459 25 2000, and don't forget that we're also going to be moving into the realms of Chinese medicine as well in a moment. And I think you know, an awful lot of people, you hear about how successful their acupuncture has been and all these sorts of things, and we're delighted to have an expert in the studio this evening.
Yeah, Tai Ping, hello, welcome to the show.
Good evening, thank you.
Hi, so you're working on traditional Chinese medicine. How long has Chinese medicine been around?
In recorded history, it's been around for 2,000 years, but its use has been probably more than that, 3,000 or 4.
So what are you doing? You're taking Chinese remedies and trying to work out how they work?
Precisely. I think as a scientist trained in England, I got fascinated by the reports that, like Dr. Luo Dinghui and her, she really transformed the treatment for eczema in the early 90s. So working together with her, I learned a great deal, and we are now applying modern technology, analytical techniques, and the study of genes, proteins, and sugars. We're trying to apply all these to try to find out how plant medicine can be produced in the future by a process of matrix, as you will.
So you've been doing some work on ginseng. What have you found out about ginseng?
It is very interesting project. Actually, we set aside some a project on ginseng because it is the most revered plant in Chinese medicine, and it actually has been reported to either promote wound healing, increase memory, and also use in cancer. So we didn't know what's going on there. So I had a hypothesis that they may ginseng plant might contain two different classes of chemicals. One class would stimulate, the other class would inhibit formation of blood vessels.
So in cancer, you have blood vessels growing, which is bad.
That's right.
So the form, you want to find something that stops the blood vessels growing to treat cancer.
That's right. And it's very interesting that when we compare different types of ginseng, and we came up with this answer, that in American ginseng, actually, this kind of ginseng contains larger amount of the compound which we inhibit, the process called angiogenesis,
so that's formation of blood vessel growth.
Yes, and there's more of that in American ginseng than in the Korean ginseng. So the opposite is true, that Korean ginseng is good for chronic wounds. So you should be very careful in what kind of ginseng you use.
So you don't want to encourage blood vessels to grow in cancer. So if you have cancer, it's the American form you need to be taking.
Absolutely.
And if you've got a wound, the Korean form.
Yes, simply put.
How do you know what's the difference? If you go into a health food shop, how do you know which one to get?
If you actually go to a good herbalist shop, and that is bring home the point of a legislation the government is trying to bring, because then we can regulate all these herbalist shops. Really, they know what they are doing. There are no cowboys out there. And I think it's most important that we work with the government to provide the assurance that these herbs are what they are.
It's like the point Monique was making as well. You know, if you have much more awareness and regulation, then you can make sure people's drugs aren't interfering with the herbal remedy and
precisely,
and so
yes.
On. So what else are you working on in the moment in your lab?
We're also working on two other projects. One is endometriosis.
What's that?
Endometriosis is actually a situation where every month during the menstruation, the endometrium of the woman actually will be sloughed off. Unfortunately, sometimes these bits would actually not be passed out. You actually go into the inside the body, peritoneal cavity of the patient, and actually when these bits actually land on different parts on the anatomy, like the colon or the ovary, they cause problems like bleeding, pains, and so on. And so that we now know it's a situation where angiogenesis is playing an important part. There's too much angiogenesis, so what we want to know is whether, actually we have shown that 3 years ago using an animal model, that if you block angiogenesis, you can block endometriosis. And now, with collaboration with China, we are looking at six different plants known for their effects in endometriosis, and we are looking at them. And some of them actually is quite popular, if you like. Angelica sinensis is one of them. Another one is the other one is safflower, which is actually present in the British garden, if you like.
So do these plants that are used often to treat the same illness, do they have chemicals in common? Is it the same kind of chemicals cropping up in all these plants?
Sometimes you do see similar chemicals present in different plants. Like in Angelica sinensis, you actually have three different chemicals which are present in other plants. So a good herbalist and chemist and biochemist should actually choose a plant which they want to isolate these chemicals from. And hopefully, like Monique was saying, that one could actually use different techniques to synthesize better compounds which one can eventually prescribe to patients.
I think it's fascinating that now, you know, we've progressed so much with science and medicine.
We've turned it on its head.
And we can look back at thousands of years of medicine and try and work out how it actually works. We've got a question from Connie in Godmanchester. And she says, how does taking herbal remedies, such as St John's wort, actually affect giving blood? You know, will it affect your blood, or just in the same way as a normal medicine? Should you tell the blood donor centre if you're taking something? What do you reckon, Monique?
I think you should, yes, very much so. I think you should definitely tell anybody you're donating blood to. And also, I think it's important that you tell your doctor that you're taking something herbal, because so frequently that doesn't happen. So the herbalist doesn't know what drugs you're taking, and the doctor doesn't know what the herbalist is giving you.
That's an interesting point, because, I mean, a lot of people will go to their doctor and their doctor will say, well, actually, there really isn't anything that I can do about this. Have you tried any other remedies? And then that person will then go and probably go to a coffee morning with a friend, and the friend will say, oh, well, I took so-and-so, that was marvellous. It's actually, this is the medicine that's travelling by word of mouth, which makes it dangerous in a way.
Yes, I would hate to say kind of dangerous, because it's so easy to put this into kind of a negative box. I mean, remember, it was our medicine, you know, until really the 1940s. So we relied on plants, and many parts of the world still totally rely on plants. It's this kind of combination when things go wrong. And the other thing is, when some of the plants are being grown now, that we are selecting plants that have higher concentrations of some of the active ingredients. So plants that are being used now often have higher levels of some of the actives. So, you know, we need to really know what we're dealing with, and to know more about the concentrations of the active ingredients in some of these herbals that are being sold. But a really professional herbalist will take a lot of this into account.
So, Sarah, you're a GP. Do you find more and more people saying, oh, I've tried this other complementary medicine or this herbal medicine?
You do have to push people, because it is something they don't often admit to, unless you say, are you buying anything over the counter, or are you taking any herbal remedies? And then they'll say, oh, yes, actually, I am, you know, doing this multivitamin. And it's something you do take into account. And it's something I find more and more people coming in to ask me, you know, what I think about various things. And often they've tried what conventional medicine can offer, and they're keen to try something else if they found conventional medicine has failed for them.
Our experts are Taiping and Monique. Would you like to see more doctors, Western doctors, having courses maybe in herbal medicine?
Of course, we very much welcome that opportunity. Actually, in this country, there's only one university which is offering such course, and that is in Middlesex University. And here at Cambridge, we have students who are interested in this kind of complementary medicine. But of course, they would have to wait until they qualified before they have a chance to actually venture into that direction.
Of course, it used to be traditional that they would be taught both. I mean, it's only in the last 10 years that the teaching of the more traditional herbal has decreased. And talking with colleagues, it's, you know, there's an increased interest in having modules.
I mean, just the other day in my practice, we had a homeopathist come to talk to us about what they can offer. And when I worked down in London, we had a Chinese and conventional medicine doctor working with us who practiced both, and it was very useful.
I mean, maybe like Taiping, if you get sick, do you go for Chinese medicine or Western medicine?
Well, that very much depends on the situation. If I had a headache, of course, I just take a paracetamol. But if I actually have a more if I'm in fear of a more chronic disease, of course, I would actually go for ring up Dr. Luo Dinghui and see what she could do for me, because I personally feel that the Chinese medicine actually is multi-targeting. By that we mean is something called fufang. That means you're blending different herbs. One of her may be anti-inflammatory, the other herb may be antibacterial, one would be provided wound healing and so on and so forth. So I do believe there's a lot to be learned from that. And could I just point out that the genome project has been so successful, we now know there are 30,000 genes here, but actually there are only about 100 genes are targets for drugs. How about the other 29,000 genes? So I think that actually opened opened the door for drug discovery that Monique and I may be able to take part.
Keep you in jobs for a few more years then.
You're listening to The Naked Scientists, 08459 25 2000 if you would like to phone in and join in our conversation this evening. And to the lines we go, because George is waiting to have a chat with Sarah about that drug, Sarah, that you were talking about a little bit earlier that keeps us awake. George, are you there?
That sounds like young Mandy.
You're through to Dr. Sarah. She's the one with the answers.
Hi, George. Hello.
Hi. You were talking earlier about a drug that keeps one awake.
Yeah, modafinil.
Yes, well, the military, amphetamines have been around for years. And the military were issued with them in the First World War. And I've been told reliably that in the likes of Iraq, etc., they're still issued now to keep one awake. So what's the difference between modafinil, as you say, something like that, and amphetamine sulfate?
Yeah, well, modafinil doesn't seem to have the horrible side effects that amphetamines have. So amphetamines can sometimes leave you feeling very depressed after you've taken them and not very well, really. But modafinil, really, apart from the side effects of headaches in a few people, is pretty good. They don't fully understand how it works, but they think that it stops nerve cells from reabsorbing a neurotransmitter in the brain called dopamine. And dopamine's an excitatory neurotransmitter, and so that's how they think it keeps you awake and how it works.
Does that answer your question?
Well, is it better than amphetamine?
Obviously.
I think better than amphetamines from the point of view it has fewer nasty side effects.
So do you fancy paying Fact or Fiction, George?
Yes, I'll play it.
Oh, go on, it'll be fine. It won't hurt a bit.
Here we go. First question, nylon got its name from the person who invented it. Fact or fiction?
Fiction.
Well done, that's absolutely right. Nylon got its name because it was developed in New York and London at the same time. So the NY at the beginning is for New York and the LON at the end from London.
Yeah. A photon is a soil particle. Is that fact or fiction?
Fiction.
Well done. A photon's actually a particle of light.
Yep. Plans.
George, you're in the lead, it would appear.
Yep, you're heading on for those tickets to go and see Kew Gardens. So,
all those wiggly wigglers.
All wiggly wigglers.
So try and keep awake and we may phone you back.
I've just taken a pill.
Thank you, George.
Drug taking live on The Naked Scientist.
08459 25 2000 at Cat.
Yes, and now we have Jack Cusick, Professor Jack Cusick from Cancer Research UK, who's talking to us live from Rome, we hope. Hi, Jack.
Hello.
We got you. We had a power cut here. It was very nerve-wracking.
Right, I'm stuck in the airport, so hopefully we can do all right.
Excellent. How's Rome?
It's warm and windy, actually. Not as bad as London at the moment.
Excellent. We've been talking about drugs, how we discover new drugs, but you're running a clinical trial, aren't you, to test whether a drug can prevent cancer. Can you tell us a bit more about that?
Yeah, I mean, this is an idea of a new use for a relatively old drug, although it's not that old. The aromatase inhibitors are becoming established as the treatment of choice, really, for breast cancer now, particularly in postmenopausal women. And we noticed in looking at those trials that not only did they stop the old tumors from coming back, but they also were blocking new tumors in the opposite breast, potentially up to 75% of them.
So what are these aromatase inhibitors? What sort of drugs are they?
Basically, they're drugs that prevent the creation of estrogen in postmenopausal women. Once the ovaries stop making estrogen is made in the peripheral tissues by converting androgens by an enzyme called aromatase to estrogen, and this blocks that pathway.
And estrogen's bad for breast cancer?
Yeah, estrogen stimulate the breast, and they certainly stimulate breast cancer. So by getting rid of estrogen, we really stop most of the stimulus to the breast. Has a very big effect on reducing recurrence, and we think also on preventing new cancers.
So this trial you're running, it's called IBIS-2. So how many people are you hoping to recruit for the trial? What sort of women are you looking for?
Well, IBIS-2 has got two components to it. The most relevant, I think, is the component for women at high risk of breast cancer. And we're looking for 6,000 women who are at increased risk of breast cancer who are postmenopausal. And the increased risk is mostly related to having a family history, a mother or a sister that's had breast cancer, or two breast cancers in the family.
And so will these women be given the aromatase inhibitor drug?
So the women all get very careful follow-up, and it's a randomized trial. The only way we can make progress is to see if this works is that all women will get a tablet, half of which will be the active aromatase inhibitor and half will be a placebo dummy compound.
Okay, and then we follow the women for how long?
So treatment is for 5 years, and then we'll follow them up for at least another 5 years. So it'll be a 10-year trial before we get a complete answer.
And if there's women listening to the show now who are, is it postmenopausal women you're after?
Postmenopausal women, mostly with a family history or a benign breast lump that's been taken out that's a high-risk kind of lump, which is essentially one that's got atypia in it.
So it's something dodgy in it.
Yes.
How can they get involved? How can they contact IBIS?
The easiest way to contact us is really to go to our website, which is IBIS-trials.org. And all the information to join the trial is there. If you don't have that, you could actually call the IBIS telephone number.
Do you know that?
0207 014-0235.
Okay, we'll have all those details up on the Naked Scientist website as well. Well, enjoy your trip in Rome, Jack, and thanks very much for talking to the Naked Scientists.
Certainly, thank you.
Cheers.
Laying the facts bare, the Naked Scientists.
Anna Lacey from The Naked Scientist went to speak to Peter Austin from the School of Oriental and African Studies about how thousands of rare languages may become extinct as languages like English and Mandarin start to take over.
Human beings have been around and speaking languages for 100,000 years or so. And even if you have two communities, say, who speak the same language, because all languages are constantly changing and their new words are coming in, old expressions going out, different fashions of pronunciation, that over a period of time, those languages will drift apart until you get to a point where they can't understand each other, and then you've got two separate languages.
I mean, this to me sounds very much like the evolution of species, say, on an island. Is this loss of some of the minor languages not survival of the fittest?
Okay, there's no genetic relationship between who we are and the language that we speak. Any child can learn to speak any language. There's no requirement that I have to be a kangaroo and not be an elephant. So there isn't a parallel to the species argument from biology, because language is a cultural aspect and we can have multiple languages coexisting in the same domain, in the same space. It's not that languages are competing with one another, it's rather that politics and economics and social and cultural power of one group is forcing other smaller groups to abandon their ways of speaking.
But are there not some benefits to having one language or fewer languages?
In the modern world, particularly in the last 50 or 60 years, there's been this belief that monolingualism is, you know, the way of the future. Well, that's simply false, and there are a number of reasons why. One is that even if people speak the same language, it doesn't mean they understand each other. It doesn't mean they're able to communicate. It doesn't stop conflict and misunderstanding. Look at Northern Ireland, the conflict we had, the troubles there. The second thing is that you and I speak English, but I still have tremendous trouble understanding lots of people here in the UK. My bank has a call centre, which is located in Glasgow, and I have a terrible time understanding these guys. We're supposed to speak English, but in fact it's incomprehensible what these people are producing from my perspective. So there are two issues. One is, yes, languages of wider communication are valuable, but it doesn't follow that you have to give up your own language in order to learn that bigger language of wider communication.
So it really is true that diversity is the spice of life, as far as languages are concerned.
Yes, and it has huge value too. It has huge economic value, it has huge political value, it has cultural value for people to be able to maintain their own cultures and languages while participating in the wider world. Monolingualism is a curse of the modern world, and that's where the danger really lies, that people can believe that by giving up languages they will be advantaged. They won't be.
That was Anna Lacey speaking to Peter Austin about why languages are so important and why we should be speaking lots of them.
That's very important. We have something in here from Rosemary, who says that she regularly uses aloe vera. She's been using it for 7 years and has told loads of people about the benefits of it. Cleopatra apparently used aloe vera in her beauty regime. And it's been used for wounds and all sorts of things. So, Monique, aloe vera, what's in that?
Well, yes, I mean, it goes back in use in Britain to Culpeper's time. It really can trace its use. It came into Britain many, many years ago. It's got some compounds in called polysaccharides that form a bit of a skin on the surface, so it helps with the wound healing process occur naturally. It's also thought to stimulate the immune system if it's sometimes ingested, but you've really got to be careful that you use the inside of the leaf of an aloe plant. So if you've actually got one inside, just make sure you use the gel, the inner substance inside that leaf, not to get some of the compounds from the outer leaf onto the wound, because that can cause a stinging sensation and cause a bit of blisters. But aloe vera is used throughout the world for treating wounds.
That's a good one.
Monique, we've had a question from Hazel. She's just called in, just wanted to tell you that her uncle used groundsel, the plant groundsel, for boils. He had one once, used the plant, and never had one again.
It's interesting he didn't have one again. I mean, I can understand how it could have some antibacterial activity, partly anti-inflammatory, that would help heal a wound. But why it had a long-term effect, I don't fully understand that.
When people use things like plants for wounds, are we talking about poultices, sort of strapping things on you?
Well, yes, but this is a fascination between what we do in parts of Europe and what happens in China. Within Europe, we often put a poultice on, and sometimes it's the leaves that are applied to the skin, or it's an extract that's put around a bandage. Whereas if you go to Asia, it's often an infusion, so it's taken internally.
As a tea or
as
something like that.
As a tea or something like that. So there's two very different approaches that can end up with the same result.
So a whole sort of systemic effect.
Yeah, yes.
It'd be interesting to know, I guess, which is more effective with certain things.
Because, of course, if you're taking it internally, then the enzymes in your gut are going to alter the chemicals, and they've got to then be absorbed from your gut and get into the bloodstream. So, you know, there's so much we just don't fully understand. I think that's why it's so exciting to be doing this type of work now, because there are advances in molecular biology and our analytical equipment that we can go back and study these plants.
Just quickly before we wrap up, do you take any herbal remedies yourself?
No, I don't actually. Would I? Yes, and I must admit I would be very interested in taking some Chinese, especially if I knew they were good quality material.
So you need to find a good Chinese herbalist.
Yes.
I think something that we have learnt from this evening's programme is that if you've got a good herbalist, then hang on to them. But basically that is the very essence of the whole thing, isn't it?
Very much so, yes.
Find someone who knows what they're doing. Well, it just remains to say thank you very, very much to our guests, Monique Simmons from the Botanical Gardens at Kew, Taiping Fan from Cambridge University. A massive thanks to Mandy for working the decks with such aplomb through a power cut. To Sarah for being here and being my medical support next to me. And back in the office, give them a wave.
Whoa.
We've got the Backstreet team over there. You've been great audience in the BBC in the Eastern Counties, and also our podcast listeners around the world. Thanks very much and good night.
Don't forget, next week we'll be looking at the technology of the future and the world of nanotechnology, and we'll be joined by Donald Fitzmaurice, Stephen Webb, David Carey and Neil Morgan. That's all from The Naked Scientists.
Sorting out the sparks from the quarks. The Naked Scientists. For more information, get online at nakedscientists.com.